You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Road. Each week we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, the state of the metagame and our picks of the week. Then on the flashback, testing results with Titan's Nest, Reanimator, and Felidar Twin. Finally on the brew session, a closer look at Glasspool Mimic in Modern and Pioneer. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 80 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, coming to you from a very snowy Minnesota. We are joined again by my guy on the left coast. He is Damon Alexander. Damon, how's it going?
Hey, just getting back from the mid-coast or Midwest. I was in Minnesota and I saw one Mr. Shriever, but not Dan Shriever. I was there as part of a big process known as moving your parents to assisted living, which is a pretty major step in terms of... an adult as they age into retirement and beyond. So that's all done, which is great news. And I also found two power artifacts in my home collection.
From Dark? Or
from Antiquities, I think.
Antiquities, yeah, okay. That's exciting.
Yeah, I don't know why I have them, and I don't think they were worth anything back then.
Yeah, they definitely were not. But now you can go infinite with Basalt Monolith very easily, so.
Yeah.
And we are, of course, joined by the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast from the East Coast. He is Cave Dan Online. Dan Shriever, what is going on?
Hey, good to see you guys. Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned my dad, Damon. He was just celebrating his 75th birthday last week, actually. So happy birthday, Dad. For those of you who've been listening to our podcast for a long time, you'll know that Damon and I grew up as next door neighbors. So when he goes home, I guess he can still wave at my dad from across the lawn. I guess you talk about your motorcycle trips to Mexico, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Your dad has some nice motorcycles.
Yeah, who knows what treasures you'll find in the closets. I think you found a Gaia's cradle last time you went back.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad the move went okay. I guess that sounded like a big life change, big transition.
Yeah. It's kind of like staging a heist in Ocean's 11 or whatever, where I was assigned the Julia Roberts role of keeping the main casino owner distracted while the team of professionals goes and raids it of all the key contents and takes it to an offsite location.
Wow. So who does that make us?
Giovanni Ribisi? I don't even know who was in there.
I'm like Amal Clooney at best.
Exactly.
So as usual at the top, we have a little housekeeping to get to. We want to welcome our two newest patrons. They are Ethan M. and Daniel B. Welcome to the Faithless Brewing Patreon. Just a reminder, you can find us on patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All supporters gain access to the Discord. They get our extended show notes with bonus content, and they get to send in questions, etc. So if you like having us answer your questions, or last week we had special guest Aspiring Spike answering some questions, that's how you get access to that. And then, of course, at higher tiers, you get early access to content. You get some merch, including our spectacular playmats and delightful custom tokens.
Yeah, big thanks to all of our patrons, everyone who has supported us, and just thanks to everyone for listening every week and hanging out with us. We really appreciate it.
So we've been doing our little election spiel. We no longer have to do that. We do have a president-elect. I don't think we need to talk about it anymore.
Well, apparently 70% of 70 million people think the election was unfair and rigged, which is kind of shocking.
Yeah, but I'm just not going to engage with that, I think. As far as the American election system, everything was safe. Everything was secure. There was no violence at any poll sites. Even with 70 million people searching for fraud, we're finding, you know, I think, two cases nationwide so far. So I think all in all, this was a very successful event in terms of the sort of American experiment. There were Republican gains in the House. So if it was rigged for the... Democrats, no one told all these House Republicans that did very well. So yeah, I think I applaud everybody who went out and voted, and I think the sort of American expression of voting is something I'm a big fan of, and I think it showed its strength even in a high stress situation this year.
Yeah, so much of what it comes out of certain media outlets and elected officials these days, it reminds me so much of the "Who Killed Hannibal Lecter" meme, where the first frame is, I forgot the other comedian's name, but he's shooting him in a chair, like empties two clips into him.
I think it's Eric and Andre, right?
Yeah, that's right, Eric and Andre. And then he turns to the camera and says, "Who killed Hannibal Lecter?" And you can be like, okay, so we've got voter suppression, we've got gerrymandering, illegal purging the ballot rolls, and then we're shooting free and fair democracy. And then we were asking, how could the Democrats do this? How could they steal the election? I don't know, man. I just don't know. But yeah, I'm hopeful that we can move past this chapter and get on with our lives. We'll see. If you live in Georgia, you still have a lot to pay attention to.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the election is not over. You're going to be living through that for another 2 months.
So let's do a quick follow-up on some of our discussions last week. So Everett Mohan was on the show, Aspiring Spike, and we had some interesting talks about sort of the state of the metagame. We talked about this sort of thesis from our good friend Stanislav about whether Green White Heliod or Heliod Company with the Infinite Life combo was like a top tier deck or perhaps the deck to beat. And it seemed like just looking at the results from this weekend, last weekend, I mean, that seems to be the case. There was a big showcase challenge on Saturday and Green White Heliod took two of the top eight slots. One of the other questions was, what about these four color Uro piles? Are they perhaps underplayed just because they're so expensive? And we thought maybe they would show up in bigger numbers the higher stakes the event was, and they were all over the place. I think there were seven of them in the top 32 of the showcase challenge. Spike said that he thought the Jeskai Flagfires was still one of the better positioned decks. And I mean, shout outs to him, put his money where his mouth is. I think he got a top 32 with that in the same event. Did you see anything from these weekend tournaments that surprised you, or did you feel like it's sort of par for the course, Modern being Modern?
Yeah, I do think at the top tier, I don't think Modern's actually that open. I think you are restricted into a few specific like sort of threat packages. I don't know that that's bad. I think you have to have kind of a tier one. I do think that this tier one is sort of better in an acceptable delta from the sort of tier one and a half, tier two decks. And I do think that there's a little bit of churn, but we used to see kind of these wild swings back and forth where people would be adjusting their sideboard cards, etc. And I think we're not doing that anymore. When you're starting to have people be able to sort of call their shots as to what's going to be big at a tournament and way ahead of time and be right, that's a sign we've kind of reached a place of relative stability.
Yeah, I agree with David. There always has to be a best deck just kind of by default. But the question is how the best deck or best decks compared to the long tail of a metagame. And Modern historically has had a pretty wide open long tail. And you'll still see that in the queues, but the challenge results do seem to point to a pretty specific metagame. And I agree with David, it hasn't seemed to kind of rotate too much week to week, where people find like the right sideboard tech to attack the metagame 1 week, making one deck overperform, and then the next week people attack that deck. It does seem pretty stable.
What are your thoughts on the Oops All Spells? I don't know if there's a better name for that deck, but the version that uses Balustrade Spy and Undercity Informer to mill a bunch of Venge Vines, get the Narc Amoebas back out of the graveyard, which brings Sword of the Meeks back, which get the Salvage Titan from the graveyard to your hand, which you can then cast by sacrificing Sword of the Meeks to trigger the Venge Vines. You know the drill, but this is a deck that, you know, when it first showed up, we were scared. It was maybe the third evolution of the Charbelcher All Spells style of decks. It did win the challenge in the hands of Sodek.
The deck I would most compare it to is probably Neobrand. On the one hand, this deck doesn't turn one as often as Neobrand, or maybe ever, depending on how many spirit guides you run. But it doesn't feel like there's really that many more ways to interact with it, like with Neobrand. You just kind of have to have like the right selection of sideboard cards to totally shut it off, or else they will win the game. And it doesn't have a ton of decision points, even though the games do last maybe 3 to 4 turns instead of 1 to 2 turns. But unlike Neobrand, this deck actually seems to be pretty good, and as we see from this winning challenge result. So I can't say I'm happy it's like a top deck in Modern, but there does tend to usually be, you know, one pretty good degenerate combo deck. I would probably rather play against Dredge than this deck, and I never really loved playing against that deck to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything Damon said is kind of hit the nail on the head. This does seem just like a better Neobrand deck. I don't think normal cards interact with it. I don't think it plays real magic. It's frustrating that, you know, I think the design of the two-sided cards is very much in line with Wizards' desire to eliminate non-games, and it's frustrating when they try to do those things and it leads to an unintended consequence like this, which is basically a deck that only plays non-games. I think the generic effect of these cards is very positive for Standard, very positive for Pioneer, very positive for Modern. This specific interaction is just an unfortunate side effect of the fact that all these cards have been printed over the course of Magic's history. It also exists in Pioneer, so it's like you play your list, you go 4-0 against real decks, and then you lose to this. So how many sideboard cards do you want to dedicate to it? Because they're not good against any other deck again.
The one quibble I would have is that I feel like it is easier to disrupt this than Niobrand, in the sense that, at least in the Modern version, once they mill their deck, they're only going to get one extra turn after that. And if anything goes wrong, if they don't bring the Vengemines back, for example, like, that's it, they're done. It feels almost brittle to me, and I know that's weird because they do play main deck Leyland of Sanctity, so they're immune to things like Thoughtseize, or somewhat resistant to that at least. Like, I've been putting Surgical Extractions in some of my sideboards lately, and that just gets them literally every time. They just are dead to Surgical Extraction. There's nothing they can do about it. But maybe Surgical is a bad card in this metagame, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you that Surgical Extraction specifically is great against this deck, but no other deck in the top eight would you bring it in against. So you have this very narrow card. You don't want to bring it against Uro or whatever. Nobody should be doing that, just as an FYI. And how many do you want to play it? Because you need to hit it in your first three turns or they're going to win the game.
And they're going to bring in their anti-Surgical sideboard cards, whether that be like the Thoughtseizes you see in Sodex sideboard or the Pact of Negations. And so then all of a sudden you have to like counter, have enough sideboard hate that you can counter their sideboard hate and counter their main deck plan. The thing with Niobrand is that the deck just was sometimes mull to oblivion and just like fizzle. This deck is so consistent thanks to just the fundamental structure of the MDFCs.
Yeah, and then you get to play your Rule of Eight, plus you get to still take advantage of Simeon Spirit Guide, which is, you know, among the better fast mana sources. And then you kind of have your like, I think they've settled on the 4 Pentad Prism, 4 Talisman of Resilience to just really turbo out your turn 3 options, and sometimes your turn 2 options are very real. I think it's cool. I mean, it is one of those things where I don't want to dismiss the innovation that's gone into it, because I think people have come up with a bunch of cool variants of it. I do think that the deck building decisions that people make are reflective of people thinking hard about the format, making cool choices, being creative. So all the things that we like as a brewer. But I think once you like actually play the deck out, once those decisions have been made, I don't think you're playing Magic anymore. I'm putting quotations around that. And so it's just a frustrating deck to exist. And it's unfortunate that in a cool format like Modern, like, this is the flagship deck. If it wins the tournament, this is what people are going to talk about. And just like, oh, okay, so my doesn't matter what deck you're playing, your main deck is going to be bad against it, and I have to put in narrow sideboard cards to interact with it.
Well, Drowsy Tron gets to play main deck Relic of Progenitus and Scavenger Grounds.
And that was the winning deck in the Sunday Challenge. So, yeah, I don't feel like the share of the winner's metagame that the All Spells deck occupies is anything out of the ordinary. I wasn't even convinced that the deck was any good at all. But I don't know, maybe it's time to acknowledge that it's a top-tier deck.
Well, whether it's good or not is not the point. I'm not saying a card needs to be banned or anything. I'm just saying you build your deck to interact with the format as it exists. And the fact that this is even a small percentage is very frustrating. If it's less than a percent, in one sense, it means the format's very healthy. You play this degenerate deck very infrequently. On the other hand, it says you shouldn't put any sideboard cards in your sideboard just to fight this deck. It's less than 1% of the metagame. But it means every time you play it, you're basically just drawing dead. So it creates this kind of tautological loop where it probably isn't that good. You can always beat it if you want, but to beat it, you have to take away your options against a plethora of other decks.
Well, I don't want to be as doom and gloom about that. I mean, any number of permanents can shut the deck down, and then it becomes a matter of, like, do they Thoughtseize you first, or do they, Assassin's Trophy, whatever it is that you brought in. So it's not like there aren't cards you can put in your 75 that will interact with it. It's just a question of, like, yeah, when the time actually comes to play that out, like, how will it go, and did you have enough, or did the variance break your way, and you might feel like, you know, you got cheated out of a match or something because you didn't draw your sideboard card and you just died. But on the other hand, maybe you will, you know, maybe you'll win, and, you know, it'll just be another day in Modern.
I do think that the rest of the top eight is kind of exactly what we'd expect to see. You know, where I think the games that everyone else is playing has a lot of play to them, and you won't find yourself mulliganing for specific sideboard cards against them, which is the kind of Magic I like to play.
All right, so that's Modern. Meanwhile, over in Pioneer, David, you had been talking about a general lack of innovation in the Pioneer formats, and that seems to be still the case, just looking at the league results and the challenge results. There's very few decks that you look at them and you think, oh, I haven't seen that before. Weirdly enough, or maybe this is even a further indictment of the format, Everett last week talked about how he hadn't played Pioneer in months and decided to just play mono green walkers and ended up winning a PTQ, even though people who played it more often told him the deck was dead. Well, now that he showed that it's not dead, you know, everyone was playing it again and they had five copies in this weekend's challenge. I don't know what that says. What do you guys think?
I mean, that really makes me think that people are just not trying to sort of piggyback on that point. When we tried out our list with Transmogrify, I think you were just like, well, I mean, should these lists be playing it? And I was like, well, I mean, I got to give some credit to these Luka players. This card is obviously very similar to Luka and they're not playing it. So they must have tried it and just not liked it. And it turns out they obviously just hadn't tried it, because as soon as someone 5-0'd with a list with four Transmogrify, now it's just a standard. So yeah, I don't know what it is about Pioneer where maybe just there aren't enough people with like clout brewing all the time. But Modern seems like a place where people are a little bit more willing to, like, quote unquote, make mistakes or play the wrong cards. And in doing so, they find cool new decks all the time. And in Pioneer, people literally are just registering the 75. And it's like, oh, Mono Green is dead. Okay, then I won't play it. Oh, someone finished with it. I will play the exact 75 they played. And that's just dispiriting. I think people should be willing to like make mistakes. And that's part of brewing. Like, you're not always going to come up with the right card. But yeah, just literally waiting for someone else to come up with a result and just printing that 75 and playing it without any variation. Like Spike said last week, though, maybe this is a GP format and, you know, we can't have GPs anymore. So when COVID is over and sometime next year and there are GPs, people just playing these stock lists will maybe get beaten by some of, you know, these sort of grinders in Modern that keep coming up with these cool lists and cool interactions. And hopefully that, you know, the incentive structure of the GP, if they're going to, I got to travel to it anyway, might as well do something different. And if that's literally something as simple as cut two Lukas and play two Transmogrifies, that actually, unfortunately, substitutes for innovation in this format, at least for better or for worse.
Yeah. Pioneer has been a little bit stale for a while now, and it's not clear what the solution is. Maybe we need, return to Throne of Eldraine, or Eldraine Dethroned or something.
I was really encouraged that Cedric just stormed through that PTQ with mono red. Or Boros Wizards, but basically mono red. And I was hoping that would kind of force these other decks to play more removal, but they really aren't playing that much removal and they're just getting away with it. So I guess aggro is just so bad against the other mid-range decks and all these decisions just kind of cascade on each other. So unless they print better red cards, I think we're just kind of stuck. I would really like to see them print like a Burst Lightning level card into the format. I think that'd be really good for the format.
Yeah, I have to say I vaguely miss Blue-Black Inverter.
Yeah, I have not like officially decided that I'm going to like come down on that point on the pod, but we're a non-zero length of time away from that happening. I really think that Smuggler's Copter would be good for the format. I really think that a Burst Lightning light card would be good for the format. I think Urien has just been terrible for the format, and that's all I can say right now.
All right, so that's the check-in on the metagame. A new thing we're trying to do is to highlight some of the coolest tech that we're seeing. We each have a pick of the week little deck we'd like to highlight. So, Damon, why don't you kick us off? What is your pick of the week?
Yeah, so I had this cool list of 5-0'd, but then I was scrolling through the challenge results, and I saw that Timu, a longtime Blue Moon pilot, had gotten second place. That's already exciting. And then I actually looked at the deck list, and oh my gosh, this is a pretty spicy Blue Moon list. In fact, it doesn't even run any moons. It runs the kind of build with boil proof with some boils on the sideboard the Spiring Spike ran, although this deck has three islands in, so it's a little bold on that sense. But it also runs a Kiki Jiki package. Furthermore, some really interesting tech it runs is Valakut Awakening. And so you run these three Kikis and these three Deceiver Exarchs, but sometimes you got to dig to find the other piece. An A plus B combo is usually not that good on its own, although every so often you Kiki Jiki a Snapcaster Mage and are happy about it. But Valakut Awakening lets you dig really fast to find the other piece if you find the right situation for it. And so this combination of all these different packages is really interesting and clearly showed to be effective this weekend.
Can you tell our listeners what Valakut Awakening does, Damon?
Oh, yeah. So this is one of the flip lands, and so the backside is a tapped mountain. The front side is two and a red for an instant. Put any number of cards from your hand on the bottom of your library, then draw them any cards plus one. And this card is obviously bad against Narset or Notion Thief, but otherwise, if you have five cards in hand plus this, you can draw six new cards. And so it lets you basically cycle as many cards from your hand as you want, and you don't even go down in cards because you draw that many plus one, and so that trades off for your Valakut Awakening.
So I imagine this is being treated as part of the mana base primarily in this build. I'm looking like 23 lands, if I'm counting the Valakut Awakening, plus your cantrip suite, and then Remands, Archmage Charms, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, these decks have always been pretty good at running 21, 22 lands with all the opts and the remands and the Serum Visions. And so just because of that, actually 22 lands was like the normal number. And so the Valakut Awakenings really do fit this role of being flexibly interchangeable between land and spell. Or maybe in his, you know, run, he just always played them as lands. I don't know for sure. I haven't actually played the list.
So it's very similar to a list that Spike himself was playing, which used the same kind of mana base, but he was playing Through the Breach Emrakul. And that list, because you're specifically looking for Through the Breach, play the double-sided land that's two and a blue, look at your top six, and find an instant or sorcery in it. So I think the sort of direct substitution is, because you neither half of the combo is an instant or sorcery, you replace it with this Valakut Awakening, which can, like Damon says, kind of turbocharge your way to find your other half of the combo.
Yeah, the Through the Breach versus Kiki combo has been, there's obviously pros and cons to both of them. One of the major cons of Emrakul Through the Breach is that it doesn't always actually win the game. Whereas Kiki plus Deceiver Exarch, barring some strange effects, does always win the game if you can stop your opponent from killing your Kiki Jiki.
I also like that he has other targets here. You know, obviously when you start Kiki Jiki-ing Snapcaster every turn, that feels great. But he has a couple Drakes in here, and that card is a very sweet Kiki Jiki target. Probably won't kill them that turn, but you're going to do a lot of damage and you can get to draw a card for your trouble.
Oh yeah, I love Crackling Drake. It's one of my favorite Magic cards ever printed. It just always impresses me what it does in a game. I mean, occasionally it's kind of a dud, but even when it's a dud, it draws a card. And it's a very kind of lean one-card kill condition, because a lot of times by the time you're deploying this and ready to start attacking your opponent, this card is, you know, 5 power, 7 power, 10 power, and then people will happily Tormod's Crypt you or whatever and then wonder why they're still dying.
Yeah, I've often liked this as kind of a juke in some of the, like, Arclight Phoenix lists. You know, you're kind of trying to turbocharge out your Phoenix. One of the ways that they can fight you, even in Pioneer, when you're relying on Treasure Cruise and the Phoenix, is attack your graveyard. As Damon's referencing, this is a card that looks at your Exile Zone and your graveyard to determine its power.
I remember my opponent blocked a 20-power Crackling Drake with Swans of Brynal Argyle once in a modern 1K. That was a strange game.
So just looking at the 60 here, I mean, there's so many little customizable pieces here. The Crackling Drakes like you're talking about, just the one-off spells. I see a Flusterstorm. I see a Peak in the main deck. These Blue Moon strategies, which, as you point out, there's no longer Blood Moons in them, they remind me now of just like, it's like totally mix and match, right? Like even down to that mana base, it's like you're a Chipotle just like building a burrito. You start with your protein. Do you want the Mystic Sanctuary or do you want the boil proof mana base? And then it's like, okay, let's go to the top end. Do you want your Kiki Jiki or do you want Through the Breach or do you just want, I don't know, what's the other option?
Oh, like Thing in the Ice plus a Planeswalker.
Rally's a Viceroy. I mean, there can't be a correct answer anymore, right?
Yeah, it's Blue-Red Tradebinder, man.
Yeah, but I think this list is a little bit more kind of cleanly put together than it looks. It's really good to have a lot of these one-ofs. I think Peak is better with a Kiki combo than it is with a Through the Breach combo, because it's more important to understand what your opponent has going on before you combo off. Whereas Through the Breach, you can do end step Through the Breach into main phase Through the Breach, for example.
Yeah, that's a more sophisticated answer than my oversimplification. But I guess it's just impressive to see all these styles of blue-red finding winning combinations. And like you said, Tiamu has been on blue-red forever. They're a master of this archetype.
And I think when you see a deck like this doing well, you can like wonder why people are always insisting that we need to unban Splinter Twin. Like, you can just play it. Here's the deck. Nothing is stopping you from playing this combo. If you just want it to be more powerful, that's a different problem. This deck just 5-0'd, and I think Tiamu's had a lot of success with it over the last couple of weeks. So as usual, most people are just wanting the deck they want to play to just be super powered. They don't actually, oh, I just like the play patterns. It's like, the play patterns are still here. You can still play a deck that is full of like blue-red interaction, counter tempo, and then with a combo finish, it's just a little bit weaker.
Yeah, not just 5-0, but second place in the challenge. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right, David, how about you? What is your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is an early nominee for the Nobel Prize next year. This is in Legacy, which is not a format we talk about a lot, but it is a Legacy deck that has 4 didgeridoos in it. So for people who are not around for the low point of Magic's history, Homelands, one of the tribes there was Minotaurs. And so there's this one card, it's very narrow, 1-mana artifact, didgeridoo, 3-mana colon, you may put a Minotaur from your hand into play. So it sort of functions like an Ether Vial, if you will, but instead of tapping, you just pay 3 colorless and you can put a Minotaur of any casting cost. and Mental Misstep put 9 Minotaurs in his deck. I guess the new card that made this more attractive is the Minotaur that gives you extra combat steps after you play lands. There is a legendary Minotaur here I had to look up. I think it's from Commander. It says every time a Minotaur comes into play, a non-token Minotaur comes into play, you make a 2/3 Minotaur. So a Herloon Minotaur for people who start playing in Revise. And then onto this is strapped sort of the Grindstone combo. So you kind of have this fair plan, if you want to call it that, which is this didgeridoo, just saving you a bunch of mana, playing these like overcosted threats for only 3 at instant speed, avoiding counter spells. Then you also have the ability to just Grindstone. You're playing the Scarecrow that makes all your opponent's spells and permanents the same color. And then you have a Trinket Mage, which finds both Didgeridoo or Grindstone. And then it's surrounded by a lot of the typical spells of Legacy. So that's Brainstorm, that's Ponder. And because you are playing red, they have 3 Red Elemental Blast main. And that is even better with your Scarecrow making all of your opponent's spells blue. So it's rare that the Red Elemental Blast will ever be dead. So it's just a super cool deck. If they ever print like even better Minotaurs, this is the kind of deck that can only get better.
Yeah, and like the thing is that you don't even need the Didgeridoo. Like you can always like hard cast a Sethron Herloon General or Morag Furia Vacuum. And I believe if I'm doing my math right that a Morag plus a Misty Rainforest is lethal in one shot. And Legacy could be a pretty lean format in terms of battlefield presence.
You can't hard cast it. How many mana producing lands are in this deck?
Well, there are 3 Ancient Tombs and 1 City of Traitors, so it actually is pretty possible to cast it, I think.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, don't forget the Pyroblast hiding in there. It's not just the Red Elemental Blast. It's 7 total. So they're really, really going hard on either the Painter angle, or maybe, Damon, would you say that Legacy is a format where you can just sort of gamble and play a bunch of Pyroblast effects?
Yeah, versus about half the field, you'll be actually extremely happy to be running 7 main deck Blast effects. Obviously, if you run into like Green-Black Death Depths and Death and Taxes a bunch, you'll be perhaps a little bit at a loss game 1. But, you know, that's not the majority of the field.
I mean, you can't always just put your Painter Servant in play and then it turns on all your other guys. So,
yeah, yeah.
I just find it so funny that, you know, presumably when they saw Morog Fury of Akum and were like, oh, wow, with a fetch land, that's lethal. Let's play Didgeridoo. Now, what are some other Minotaurs that I can play? Like, well, the next best Minotaur is Boros Battle Shaper. So 7 mana, 5/5 that lets you, lock a creature out of combat or force a creature to block.
Yeah, is this card even good in sealed deck? Like, I'm surprised this card made the cut.
I wonder if it like gets around blockers and stuff. It just prevents your opponent from actually like interacting with your Akum, Fury of Akum combo. You just each combat, you just pick that it can't block this combat. And so you can get through your, you know, whatever.
Never going through a true name, but nobody plays that card anymore. Yeah. Interesting point.
I've had this card in play a lot in like draft. It's very powerful, but it wasn't a good card even in draft.
Yeah, so 6 and 5 toughness. So, you know, avoiding lightning bolts.
Exactly.
You're going to get a lot of life with these sorts of plowshare, these bad boys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, then you kind of have your, like, backdoor combo. Like, while they have to deal with all your giant Minotaurs, eventually you kind of put together your Painter's Servant, Grindstone, and the game ends.
Honestly, I find this sideboard even funnier than the main deck. I mean, we have a Mind Harness, which is 1 blue, gain control of enchanted creature, if, of course, you have a Painter Servant in play, but a few minor drawbacks, cumulative upkeep 1, and play only on a red or green creature. So I guess somehow this is, like, very good against the Rugged Elver decks, which are at the top of the meta right now. And maybe you just bring it in against Death and Taxes. So if your Painter Servant is out, you can steal, I don't even know what.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's even a Sabo's Web, which was made to counter Rashad and Port. Features Liam Neeson on the front of it.
Yeah, so because they have 1 Trinket Mage, I guess, they kind of have a little like Trinket Mage package of cards that can bring in Engineered Explosives, Tormod's Crypt, Graft Digger's Cage, Pything Needle. I just love Trinket Mage. I love that it somehow can fetch Didgeridoo and Grindstone. Each is a key piece in your combo. I'm putting quotation marks around that. And then it finds useful sideboard cards as well. So it's a shuffle for Brainstorm. It does it all.
And what do you know that Didgeridoo is the most expensive card in Homelands by about a factor of 2? It's almost more valuable than the rest of the set combined.
Yeah, I mean, it's reserve lists, unfortunately. And people have been like memeing, trying to like, you know, make, you know, didgeridoo shops or something and vintage a thing. I didn't think anyone would actually ever do it. So I would say get in before the spike, but like Painter's Servant, Grindstone, and Didgeridoo are all very expensive already. Maybe you can get your Boros Battle Shapers before they spike.
And Didgeridoo is also a card people love to speculate on. Every time there's any set with a Minotaur, I mean, even something as crazy as Boros Battle Shaper seeing play in Legacy because of how powerfully effective Didgeridoo is. So if they printed like a Agent of Treachery type of Minotaur, it would just be an insane card somehow. So it's like a reasonable card to spec on.
Oh yeah, I'd say that we're one busted Minotaur away from totally destabilizing the shape of Legacy, although maybe that moment's already happened.
So anyway, super cool deck. Congratulations to the brewer. I don't know if they've been like waiting with their didgeridoos for a long time, or they were just like looking at Trinket Mage, seeing that it can fetch Grindstone, and then they just look through their Homelands pile and like, what is happening here? It's all coming together.
Mental Misstep is a MTGO hustler.
All right, so we'll dip back to Modern for my pick of the week, which comes to us from Jiggy Wiggy, a friend of the show, longtime brewer and Niv-Mizzet pilot, now one of the co-hosts of the Serum Visions podcast, along with our friends Mana Symbol and Brian Madden. This is a Jiggy Wiggy pile, and if you follow the Modern subreddit closely, you'll know that a Jiggy Wiggy pile means it's 61 cards, some number of Kinnan Bonder Prodigy, a bunch of Emrys, Engineered Explosives, Mishra's Baubles, and then you have about 20 slots. Maybe you have about 16 slots that are flex that give you the flavor of this particular Jiggy pile. This one uses the flex slots on an Arayo Soratami Ascendant package. What is Arayo Soratami Ascendant? Well, it is one in a blue for a 1/1 flying legendary creature from Kamigawa. When the fourth spell of a turn is cast, you flip it into Arayo's Essence, which is a legendary enchantment that counters the first spell that your opponents play on each turn. Okay, so you want to cast four spells in one turn, assuming that they're not going to help you. That means you need a bunch of free spells, and it used to be that you could do this with Mox Opal. That's banned, so Mox Amber has to step up to the plate. So you have Mox Ambers, you have Repeal as a one mana way to like bounce your Amber and recast it. Springleaf Drum, obviously Kinnan works with all of these cards. And then to hold it all together, we have Karin the Great Creator, and there's even some Ancient Stirrings in here to find some of your key pieces, being either the Karns or your artifacts or your Engineered Explosives, which is your key interactive piece.
Yeah, I love the look of this deck. I think Ancient Stirrings is a really cool addition because it's sort of the cantrip that you need to like keep the churn up. You find your Mishra's Bauble to go with your Emry. It also helps put cards in your graveyard for Uro. Yeah, that natural curve of like two mana Arayo on that same turn, play Bauble, repeal it, play Bauble. That's four spells exactly. So that is your flip. And then, yeah, like you have all this extra mana, and if you don't get all these combo pieces together, the deck has a lot of individually weak cards. So you have Karn, and that can kind of cheese out wins in Modern because there's a bunch of, you know, we've talked about it before, four or five cards that are great in certain matchups. So, yeah, I think this deck is really, really cool construction. I don't get the 61 cards. Is that like Penn Jillette where he always has the painted nail or something? It's just the trademark? Or
I think so, yeah. It's like for a balanced breakfast, you need the 61st card.
Got it.
So Arun took this to a 5-0 last week. If you're looking for more just sort of iterations on this style of deck, they talked about it in some detail in episodes 3 and episode 4, 3 and 4 of Serum Visions. Bunch of different variants on Arayo specifically, and they've learned a lot about it in their sort of iterative approach to brewing. Unfortunately, it's not a lockout. You can flip it to Arayo's Essence, and it buys you time. I guess it's somewhat similar to a Chalice of the Void. It's like hard to break through it, but not impossible. So you do need to win the game with something else, and I guess that's where the Uros and the Karns do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, I think it probably is also good that Jund isn't around anymore. Abrupt Decay gets around the counterspell effect, right? So not really seeing a lot of Abrupt Decays makes this effect much more powerful than it had been in previous Modern metagames.
Yeah, I think Canister took this list through a prelim the other day. Didn't go very well. I think it was an 0-3 drop, but I believe he said something like this deck is somewhere between incredibly broken and completely unplayable. We'll take that. For a fresh brew, we'll take that.
Yeah, and let's be real. I mean, if you're playing as Jund, can Jund even beat Uro? No.
I'm really intrigued by the Pongifies in the sideboard. This is a card we've played in our main deck, of course, where we're no stranger to Pongify in Modern. So obviously they felt like they needed removal. It's unconditional removal, so this must have been the best option for certain cards that they're really worried about. So that's kind of an interesting choice to me.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any matchup where you'd specifically want Pongify over anything else, Dismember even. But it is unconditional-ish.
But yeah, super cool deck. And I mean, the Karn sideboard just is always going to give you game. Like fast mana plus Karn can just find cards sometimes on the play. You know, all right, your Arial thing didn't come together or your opponent was able to disrupt it. Like Karn just naturally is going to do good things for you. So I think it's good to just have that as your fallback after your other stuff, if your other stuff doesn't come together.
Yeah, definitely. If this sounds intriguing to you, encourage you all to give it a try. This style of deck tends to be thin on threats. I mean, there's only like 12 cards here that actually do anything. And in terms of interaction, it's basically Engineered Explosives, Karn, or Bust. But in exchange, you get some truly astonishing opening sequences, and it's just a really fun playstyle. So shout outs to Jiggy and the Seer and Visions crew for this 5-0 result. All right, so let's leave it there. Those are our three picks of the week, two from Modern and one from Legacy, coming soon to a Legacy 1K near you. We will take a short break. When we come back, we'll have our flashback talking about some of the lists that we played last week. Stay with us.
Welcome back. So last week, with me not present, the podcast fell into a bit of disarray and we didn't have a card to brew around, leaving us with a dealer's choice for what to play. So David played a couple fun-looking lists. So do you want to tell us how those went?
Yeah, so I kind of continued my exploration of sort of Sultai in general. I feel like Sultai has all the best cards, and we just haven't figured out the best way to play it. I know Dan and I have talked about that too with the various Delirium Shells, and we've iterated on those a bunch of different times. And even now at the Pioneer Challenge, Doomike had a very good finish with another sort of iteration of just sort of classic Sultai Delirium. So I took my Sultai Nest, so taking advantage of the card Titan's Nest, back into the queues. And I tweaked a few cards, I updated my sideboard, and I just wanted to get, you know, a few more reps in. And the deck felt awesome. I went 4-1. I lost to Spirits, but dominated a bunch of pretty good players. I even played Timu on blue-black mid-range control. He unfortunately didn't draw very well in either of our games, but it was 2-0, not close. The list felt super sweet, and so I feel like there's a lot here, and specifically the card, like, Shark Typhoon is just so good against these other, like, Urien piles. This, unlike these other decks, has a tougher matchup against aggro, and so it's nice to have, like, a pretty good match in your game one against Urien piles. I feel like normally I lose to them game one, I have to have all these sideboard options. This one, I just feels very comfortable, so...
Unless you have two sideboard Thought Distortions, so even more game against the Urien piles.
Yes.
So, again, you're looking to mainly hard cast the Shark Typhoons here?
I'm looking to hard cast Shark Typhoon the turn after or the turn I play Titan's Nest. So, Titan's Nest basically gives all your spells delve. So, if you play Titan's Nest with a blue mana up, if you have five cards in your graveyard, you can play Shark Typhoon that turn. And the turn after you play it, you can always play it, basically, because it will put one card in your graveyard. So your ways of filling the graveyard are Sylvan Caryatid and Commune with the Gods, as well as two Thirst for Meanings. And then the other sort of outlet you have for all your extra mana is for Fae of Wishes. So Fae of Wishes is a card that sort of lets you tutor your sideboard, and it only has one colored pip in the wish part of it. And so we have a lot of targets that are also relatively colorless heavy that lets us kind of find the piece we need to win. Your most common target is often part the Water Veil. And you just have these amazing turns where it seems like your opponent's about to win. You're losing most of the game, and then you basically untap with a Shark Typhoon, Fae of Wishes for part the Water Veil, cast it. If you can kick it, that's great. And then they're dead. So, and they never even see it coming.
I feel like you'd be vulnerable to counter magic.
You know, you are somewhat vulnerable to counter magic, but there is not that much counter magic being played. These Urien lists, you know, rely on just, they're very sorcery speed oriented. They have a few counter spells, but especially if you play around, you know, just leaving one extra mana up for your key turns. I'm always exiling like one extra card from my graveyard instead of tapping an extra mana just so I have it just in case. That's the most common counter spell. You're only seeing a couple of sort of neutralized like effects in the 95 or 75 of these Urien lists.
Yeah, and the thing is also that, like, I've made this mistake myself. We're like, oh, I will definitely let granted resolve. I can just counter the spell they get with it. And then they get thought distortion, and the game goes very poorly from there.
The other thing is, against counterspell decks, you can always just cycle Shark Typhoon, which is like just a built-in 2-for-1. Your deck is just mana, basically. And if they're not putting a clock on you, you know, you're just playing a bunch of Uros and cycling Shark Typhoons a bunch. So you kind of have a multiple avenues to pressure their Planeswalkers and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the Fae of Wishes and Cider Wayfinders contribute an 8 total power across the deck to forward progress if the other plans don't work.
Yeah, Balaghead Recovery to get one back if it dies.
The other thing I like is a deck like this that's kind of full of a lot of air and you do worry about decking, you just get to put like one Jace Wielder of Mysteries in your sideboard and you have your 4 Fae of Wishes to go find it. So in a lot of these like grindier matchups when they do have counter spells or, you know, you're going back and forth with Sultai Delirium and the way the cards worked out, you didn't get to like win normally, you can just find your Jace, play it that turn, and end the game. You don't have to worry about not having enough threats in your deck. You have like the one threat that neutralizes your lack of threats.
Is that just theory crafting or did that happen in your gameplay?
I did not do it in this league, but in the first league I played, that is how I beat a, it was like a Bant Flash list that had like 4 Teferi, 4 Brazen Borrower. And so we had just traded resources. I was really just trying to like stick a Shark Typhoon to win and couldn't do it. And they kept drawing exactly the removal. And then finally at the end, I just Fae of Wished for the Jace with very few seconds on my clock and resolved it to win.
Jace wins when you run out of cards in your deck, not when you run out of time on your clock.
That would be a sweet card.
That would be your Planeswalker static ability, David.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so 4-1 with this, and I think you went 4-1 the previous time.
I think I went 3-2 twice, but we have a Patreon who went 4-1 with this previously. So he and I have been doing some theory crafting on the Discord, which people who pay to be patrons can get access to. And we talked it over about little edits we liked. I added 2 Thirst for Meanings instead of, I was playing the blue-green Planeswalker that you can like plus and name a card and look at your top 4.
Tamiyo Collector of Tales.
Yeah. So I replaced Tamiyo Collector of Tales. I got rid of a Growth Spiral and added another Satyr Wayfinder. I added a little bit more removal to the sideboard and kind of cut down on some of my wish targets because I was kind of getting the same ones every time. And yeah, the deck just played a little bit smoother, and that's kind of all you need because you win a lot of games at like 4 life.
Yeah, that's awesome. Great result. Encouraged to hear that we're slowly refining the list.
Yeah, so up next, David has another Sultai list, also featuring a bunch of Uros, but the rest is pretty different.
Yeah, so we talked about the Thwart the Grave list last week, Dan and Everett and myself, and they were just like, you know, some of these one-offs are really not cutting it. The Vampire Cleric was underwhelming in my original proposed list. A while ago, I was playing 2. I went down to 1. I didn't really like it. They both recommended I play a 24th land instead of the 4th Caryatid. I cut the Murderous Rider main deck for an Abrupt Decay. And the big thing is I added 2 Jace Friend's Prodigy and cut the 4 mana Sphinx and one other card I can't remember. And I tweaked my sideboard a little bit. So, yeah, I went 3-2 and 4-1 with this list, and the Jaces were really good. They just didn't die. All these Urien lists just don't play that much removal. And another thing that came up a lot was if they enchant their land with Chain to the Rocks and they exile your Agent of Treachery or whatever, when you take control of that land, Chain to the Rocks falls off. It says enchant a mountain you control.
Oh, wild.
So I just kept getting my Urien opponent. They would Chain to the Rocks to get rid of whatever, and then I would take that land specifically, and they'd lose their Chain to the Rocks, and I'd get back whatever creature they had underneath it. Even if it was just like an Earl or something, at least it'd be a free draw. But there are multiple times where I would like have an agent in play. They'd had to kill it to protect their Teferi or whatever. Then I'd get another agent in play, take that land, get another agent, take their Teferi.
Huh, so it's kind of like Chain to your Rocks.
Yeah, exactly.
I never knew that.
So do you feel like this list is closer? How far off do you think it is from its...
Yeah, I think the final move is to cut Yarok, unfortunately.
No.
It's cool when you get to get Yarok into play with Agent of Treachery specifically, or if you get it in play and then you play Uro. But the problem is there's just so few aggro decks, and the ones that exist are almost like combo aggro, so Yarok's ability to block is just not that useful. I didn't want to play the fourth agent. This was sort of like a cheating version of it that you could play normally, and it functions as an extra agent if you get it back. But I think you're better off maybe just main decking a Notion Thief or another Jace Fringe Prodigy is what I would recommend. But the list, I mean, the list is just super sweet. It's really smooth. You can kind of beat anybody. You are a little bit stuck in terms of variance, like what you're, like if your Wayfinders miss or whatever, that always sucks. Whatever champion wits like kind of loots you through. But your best draws basically can't be beaten by anybody, and you can compete even with bad draws because you have all this looting. So,
yeah, I found when I played it last week that if you want something really explosive to happen early, there you need the variance to sort of go your way. You need to draw a thwart early, maybe with some party members in play. But if you're not concerned about speed, I mean, the longer the game goes, like, you can't counter an Eternalized Champion of Wits. That's just pay 7, you get to draw 4 cards. You discard 2, but who cares? And you have 4 of those in the deck. So it's a really amazing long game deck, which is refreshing given how slow a lot of the decks are in Pioneer right now.
Yeah, and it puts a lot of pressure on cards like Soul Guide Lantern, which is a card that a lot of people bring in. So you have a Champion of Wits in your graveyard and 6 lands in play. They know you likely have an Earl in your hand because we're late in the game. They just have to crack their Soul Guide Lantern proactively for quote-unquote no value. Or you just get to draw on your turn. If you play a land, you never give them priority. So the people who tried to get really cute and wait for Earl to go to the graveyard just got blown out by that. I just got all kinds of, like, as soon as Champion gets put into play in the late game, it's just such a huge swing. It's like a super Muldrifter or something.
It really is. You feel unbeatable.
And it's even great against counterspell decks. You know, they think they're in control and, like, you just keep playing your lands. And as a ramp deck, you're just so good against them. You are going to play Champion of Wits from the graveyard. You start to be able to hard cast Agent of Treachery and just have all these bombs, some of which they cannot interact with counter magic. So
yeah, this deck is a blast to play. I'm thinking I might take it out for another spin, seeing your updated build here.
Yeah, so cut Yarok for whatever you like. If it's Notion Thief, it's Jace. I do think that Abrupt Decay is better than Murderous Rider. The 2 mana matters. Once you're playing Jace, the ability to flash it back matters. Better against aggro, obviously. So I think that change is just a lock. And then in sideboarded games, you just want Abrupt Decays anyway because all the graveyard hate is something that Abrupt Decay can likely kill. There aren't cards that, other than specifically Kalidus, I guess, but you still get to kill Rest in Peace. You get to kill their Soul Guide Lantern if you want to do it, you know, in a timely fashion or whatever else. It also kills Scavenging Ooze. So those are all the common graveyard hate pieces.
All right. So that's Pioneer. I'm going to switch over to Modern to talk about the decks that I played. So I knew that we wanted to talk about Glasspool Mimic for this week's show, and we'd done a little bit of exploratory work on this 3 weeks ago, I want to say, for our Rogues episode. And I think I mentioned that I had tried out a list that was exploring the Felidar Guardian Splinter Twin, quote-unquote, Splinter Twin package. What am I talking about? Well, a Felidar Guardian plus a second Felidar Guardian will just blink each other infinitely. That doesn't actually accomplish anything, and that has nothing to do with Rogues. However, a Felidar Guardian and a Glasspool Mimic will also blink each other infinitely, except that Glasspool Mimic retains the Shapeshifter and Rogue creature types, which means that if you have a Thieves Guild Enforcer in play, that loop will actually mill the opponent out. So the hope was that, yes, it's a 3-card combo, but none of the 3 cards are actually bad. That was the hope, at least. Yeah. There's no Saheeli Rai, who's like a total clunker or something. These are plausible cards. You know, Glasspool Mimic can just be a land. You don't even have to cast it. It's actually a somewhat compact combo in terms of, you know, end step Thieves Guild Enforcer for just a single mana. Untap, you can just play the Glasspool Mimic that turn even as a land, Felidar Guardian, blink it, and you're done. So my first build, I went 3-2, and that was one where I was playing some speculative cards, Acquisitions Expert, which Damon has teased me about, and Watcher for Tomorrow and Ephemerate. It was more on a blink plan. When we discussed it, we thought about other ways to sort of speed things up, and I was interested in maybe reanimating things, given that Vesper Lark actually can grab all 3 of the combo pieces. Vesper Lark can grab any creature with power 1 or less, and that includes Felidar, that includes Thieves Guild Enforcer, and it includes Glasspool Mimic. So I was like, okay, you know, maybe that can be my main way to sort of get this back. You know, maybe some unearths will round out the reanimation package, and I'll borrow a little bit of Lawson Zandi self-mill tech and play Hedron Crabs to find my pieces more quickly that way. So I tried this second iteration probably 2 weeks ago, and it didn't really work out. I think I went 2-3, and I only reanimated 1 thing in the course of the league. So it looked like I just didn't have enough reanimation going on. So I thought maybe forget about Vesper Lark. Let's just go back to something more tried and true. Something closer to the just generic Flash Rogues shell. Because my sense from you guys was that you two were mostly happy with the card Soaring Thought Thief, right?
Yeah, it was a fine card.
Yeah, I can see that if you're going for a combo kill, it might not be doing its best.
No, it doesn't contribute at all to the combo kill, except that it makes your Thieves Guild Enforcers like slightly better. You're slightly less embarrassed to have a Thieves Guild Enforcer in your deck. It gives you like a Delver plan that can shift later to a Mimic Twin package. That was the hope anyway. So the third version, which I played this week, was 4 Thieves Guild Enforcer, 4 Soaring Thought Thief, and then the rest of my stuff was cheap interactions. So Thought Scours, Fatal Pushes, and 4 Drown in the Lock. Nice little flex card there. A couple Snapcasters. Then the top of the curve needs to support Felidar Guardian. I don't want to make Thieves Guild Enforcer good and then make Felidar Guardian terrible. So you need to have enough stuff that Felidar can blink for value, and that was a bit of a challenge. So I put Teferi's main deck on your suggestion, David, 2 Omen of the Seas. And I think there's probably 6-ish things that Felidar could blink for value. I put an Omen of the Dead as well. And you can always just blink a Glasspool Mimic and make another creature if you don't have Thieves Guild Enforcer. So this was sort of my third build. What do you guys think of this style of construction?
You already have a note here, so I don't want to push it too much, but I don't get this like Thieves Fortune. I know you said somebody online was saying this is one of the key cards unlocking rogues. I just don't get it. I think I would much rather have Slitherwisp here because you're playing all these sweet flash cards. As soon as you start adding Omen of the Sea, you have one basic plane, so that's kind of tough. But other than that, I would maybe like to see like Slitherwisp as a 2-of. But I mean, this list looks pretty good to me as like a good starting point. And I know you've been iterating off of it, so I'm kind of interested to hear how it went.
Yeah, I'm not convinced about going for this kind of Delver angle in the sense that Thieves Guild Enforcer plus Soaring Thought Thief feels like it only really works in Modern as a way to kill an opponent with just those with a ton of support. And you dilute that support by going for the Felidar Guardian package.
What kind of support would you need, though? I mean, I feel like there weren't that many supporting cards that even existed in the Rogues archetype.
Well, there's like the kind of counter magic cards, a little bit more like Thoughtseizes or whatever.
I see.
In each of these iterations, Dan, were you ever winning by normal damage, or were you only winning when you sort of assembled the Felidar Splinter Twin combo?
I would say normally by damage, only occasionally by the Felidar combo, but that depended on how much card selection I put in. So this build's version 3 had the 2 Omen of the Seas, and then a fair number of cantrip cards, 3 Teferis, 2 Snapcasters, 4 Thoughtscours. So there's Into the Story here. So it had more card draw than before. Like version 2 was just not doing it at all. This version, I think I combo killed maybe twice in the league that I played. So not a ton. So I played one league with this. I also played my community league matches. We're running a modern season of our Faithless Brewing community league. So I got a pretty good feel for like how it works. It's like a pretty functional deck. You are absolutely right about Thieves Fortune. That has been cut since since I threw this together. Those can just become anything else, another land or whatever.
Could be Slitherwisp. Could play Slitherwisp.
Yeah,
Slitherwisp,
you could play Slitherwisp, I suppose.
It's a legal card to put in your deck.
The Delver angle, I'm not sure. Like I go back and forth on that, Damon, because there are some matchups, like if you find yourself paired against Tron, for example. You basically just have to race, and you have to choose. Like, you want to race with damage and hope to Delver them out, in which case the Soaring Thought Thief is your best hope. Or do you want to race to combo, in which case, the Soaring Thought Thief has nothing to do with that. So I see what you're saying. Like, it seems at odds with the Splinter Twin angle. So I was thinking about these problems and still hadn't reached any firm answers, so I decided to play one more version of the deck. This is version 4. And it was going back to the Ranger Captain of Eos from my original build, which I really liked quite a lot. So that's probably one of like the better things that you can blink with Felidar Guardian. I found that in version 3, if I got paired against like a Jund style deck, which happened, I think, twice in my league. I was just getting ground outs and I didn't have enough clean ways to pull ahead on cards. I was especially like having a lot of times where I would draw Felidar Guardian and still not really have anything good to blink with it. So I wanted to remedy that somewhat by putting more good blinks in. So a Ranger Captain is a good blink. Because I have the four Ranger Captains, I don't just want to have to get Thieves' Enforcer. I want something else good. But instead of Giver of Ruins, like I was playing in my first build, this time I wanted to play Death Shadow as my four of. Just because you hemorrhage a lot of life anyway, getting all these shock lands. And that has cascading effects. That means that you do have to play Thoughtseize main deck, which my other versions were not doing. So it has, yeah, you end up with a somewhat leaner package of Thoughtseize, Fatal Push, Thieves Guild Enforcer, and Death Shadow all in the one slot. Still playing four Drowned of the Locks, four Ranger Captain of Eos, three Teferis, four Felidar Guardians, two Omen of the Seas, and four Soaring Thought Thief are still here, along with the four Glasspool Mimics. This build, I played this last night, and it started off a lot better. I was 4-0 at one point, but I lost the last round to like a weird Abzan deck. Got ground out, unfortunately.
It's funny you're saying that deck is weird. Meanwhile, he's like, I was playing for the 5-0 and I was playing some kind of...
Exactly.
Yes.
Esper or Felidar. He was playing stock Esper Guardian.
Yeah.
Somebody out there is like, yeah, oh man, I got a 5-0 on my weird Abzan deck. Last round was against a weird Esper deck.
Exactly. So that matchup specifically, like the Soaring Thought Thief was so bad because I was like a little bit flooded and just like it didn't contribute to my plan whatsoever. And I was just like praying for Omen of the Sea. I just couldn't draw them. So it made me think maybe I should just cut the Thought Thieves and just forget about that. Just play Omen of the Sea. Because the rest of the deck felt like I had upgraded the average power of my cards. You know, something that ever talked about is just got to put more good cards in the deck. Ranger Captain and Death Shadow and Thoughtseize are good cards in a way that a lot of my other builds were not playing good cards in versions 1-3.
But you could put Acquisitions Expert in. That said, I definitely agree that this deck looks like by far the best of your iterations on that merit alone. Ranger Captain Death Shadow is a much more aggressive Delver plan than Thieves Guild Enforcer Soaring Thought Thief. And it also just seems to be a better home for Felidar Guardian besides the combo angle.
You know, I think there's even some just natural, you know, you could replace your four Soaring Thought Thieves with like two Omen of the Sea, one Snapcaster Mage, one Opt or something. And all of a sudden your Felidar Guardians are better. You find your combo faster. Snapcaster Mage kind of is one more extra of Drown, Fatal Push or Thoughtseize. And then your Teferi has more stuff to blink of your own for value. So, yeah, I think this deck looks really, really cool. And it's encouraging that even in this nascent stage, you are still having success with it. You know, I think Weird Abzan is pretty dominant in the meta right now, so you're going to have to make some adjustments for that. But, you know, you're not going to see it every league, so you might be okay.
I know. I was just hoping to fade it. I wanted to use my one time, but I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I should mention that there were probably two matches where the Soaring Thought Thieves were really good out of the five matches that I played with this build, and then two matches where they were horrible. So I'm just, like, not sure. If you cut them, you're really leaning on... Well, you're leaning on the Thieves Guild Enforcer and Death Shadows in Wild in the Cattle mode to just sort of provide some angle of attack. What I've learned through all these leagues is that the Rogues problem with Uro is still very real, and it's just like so depressing to mill an Uro in game one and realize you're suddenly a massive underdog and probably going to lose. And Death Shadow at least gives you something else to do. So between Death Shadow and then hoping to sort of stall until you assemble your mill combo, you can actually somewhat recover from them having Uro. But that being said, adding the Soaring Thought Thief just kind of increases your liability when you're on that plan, because they force you to mill every time you want to attack for chip damage with Thieves Guild Enforcer. So I'm not sure. I mean, this is a deck that it's like got the bare minimum amount of life loss for Death Shadow. Like, there's no Street Wraith here. It's got the bare minimum amount of mill. Like, there's no Thought Scours anymore, because, David, I think you were correct. Those are a kind of a weak card. So you're playing Drowns with very, very few guarantees that you'll actually have the Drowns turned on.
Yeah, what if you just cut the Thought Thieves for four Street Wraith?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, you can play 61 cards, you can play 60 cards, or you can play 56 cards.
I'll think about that. All right, well, I'll post all these builds and I'll probably keep tinkering with this strategy this week as we're exploring Glasspool Mimic, but I guess I'll leave it there for the time being, unless you have any further thoughts on changes I should make right now.
I mean, I think you've correctly identified like the weak link is the Soaring Thought Thief, and then what you want to do with that is kind of up to you, and that might involve more iterations. Is it, you know, Omen of the Sea, Snapcaster Mage, Thought Scour to replace the mill? Is it more control? Is it, if you cut them, do you need to cut some number of drone locks because they aren't as good? But I think, you know, once you kind of diagnose the cards that are maybe the ones holding you back, then you can start A/B testing everything.
Yeah. All right. Well, that sounds good. So I have my homework cut out for me. We will take a short break. When we come back, we will have our brew session. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Our card for this week is Glasspool Mimic, and this is 2 and a blue for a 0/0. Sounds bad, but there's some text. You can have it enter the battlefield as a copy of a creature you control, except it stays as a shapeshifter rogue in addition to these other types. Alternatively, you can play it for its backside, which is a tapped land that taps for blue mana. This is a weird card, just all these clone effects are always strange. So some notes on this is that the default side is the creature side. And so this is why if you use a Feldar Guardian to flicker the land half of it, it comes back as the clone half of it, for example. The only way to get the land side is to specifically use the game action to play a land. You can't use Uros or Growth Spirals on that side of things. You can also get into play by, for example, Aether Vial, all these sorts of things. It's just a creature on the front side, and so that's what most of the rules for when it's in your hand. Can you Thoughtseize it? The answer is yes, et cetera, et cetera. Just as a general FYI on clone effects, you don't announce the copy creature until it actually enters the battlefield, which means that it has to resolve first. And so you don't say, I cast clone targeting whatever. You say, I cast clone, and your opponent has to figure out what they think you're going to target before they decide if they want to counter it. And then once it resolves is when you choose what it will enter as. One thing to keep an eye out for is that if you have just, you know, one creature out and your opponent kills in response, it's going to enter with no possible choices and be a 0/0 and die immediately, which is usually undesirable. And so you have to just be aware of this vulnerability of clones.
That happened to me against that Abzan pile. I can confirm. It feels real bad. Real bad.
Yeah. As a comment involving the card specifically Collected Company, which we may have some lists involving or maybe not, you have to choose a creature already in play. And so if you hit Glasspool Mimic plus another creature off your Coco, you can't choose the other creature because it will not be eligible at the point it enters the battlefield because they enter at the same time.
Also, Thwart the Grave, similar effect. If that is your rogue or second card, it can't counter your Agent of Treachery or whatever.
Oh, interesting. That is a good, pretty relevant for that deck. Quick comment, the card obviously says this on the front side, but it can only copy creatures under your control. And so this is, in that sense, kind of an inferior clone to cards like, well, Clone or Phantasmal Image. But it is a strict improvement to Mirror Image from M17? I mean, I forget which set that was.
19, maybe? 20?
No, it was a while ago, I think. I think it was either M19 or M18. If only there was some way to find out what set a card came from. Nope. We'll have to go pull out our Scry magazine and flip to the back pages. The card, as it says, retains the shapeshifter rogue creature type. And if you're interested in, for example, using this plus Feldar Guardian to go infinite with a Thieves Guild Enforcer, this is a critical line of text. And maybe there's other ways to use this that we haven't even thought of. And lastly, you can always choose to not copy anything. And so, for example, if your opponent has some bridges from below that you really want gone, you can be satisfied that they're banned, or you can play this as a 0/0 if you're playing Legacy or for whatever other reason you want to have another card in your graveyard. So going into the general concept of clones, clones are at their best when either you or your opponent are playing good creatures. And this is a clone that only targets your creatures, which means that it's best when you're playing good creatures that also survive, or enough creatures that there's a few targets on the battlefield. And so we already get pushed into a direction of playing a deck that plays a lot of creatures to make it worthwhile. Otherwise, the entering a battlefield as a tapped blue source is probably not quite good enough if you have like a pretty low chance of getting a good clone off. So with that said, I know Dan has a couple questions about this card, so I'll pass it to him.
Yeah, I think when we were trying to evaluate these double-sided MDFC cards, there was always a question of like, how much extra are you paying for the front half in exchange for the option of playing the land side? And this one was one of the hardest ones for me to evaluate because I just couldn't quite tell how much mana a clone is supposed to cost. Obviously, the original clone costs 4, and Phyrexian Metamorph gives you a mana discount on that. So you can have a 3-mana clone that clones anything, including artifacts. But in Modern, the only clone that really saw any play is the 2-mana one, Phantasmal Image, which comes with a drawback, right? It's fragile. It will die to anything. In the 3-mana clone space, I just don't know if this is a good rate for a card. So I guess I'll put it to you guys. Like, how much is a clone worth? How much should a clone cost? Or maybe why don't we see clones played very often?
I think 3-mana is too much for a clone of anything. And so I certainly think that 3-mana to clone your own creature is not good enough on its own. Phantasmal Image being 2-mana was super important back when the Legend rule was different, because it actually let you kill Geist of St. Traft and Thrun the Last Troll. Unfortunately, Thrun never got its time in the sun because there was literally a 2-mana card that killed the dead. The way that creatures are these days, I feel like their coming to play effects are already spells. So spending a spell to kill Phantasmal Image was never the drawback I think Wizards intended it to be.
So Phyrexian Metamorph and Phantasmal Image both are really strong cube cards. And 3-mana for the Metamorph, you have to pay the 2 life in addition, is a pretty good rate. Obviously, cube and modern are definitely not the same format, and sometimes cube is a higher power format depending on legacy or vintage cube, although modern decks are obviously much more consistent. The big thing is that, first off, in modern, you don't see quite as many big creatures like Consecrated Sphinx. The big creatures tend to be cards that are pretty specialized, like Primeval Titan, and copying your opponent's Primeval Titan usually is not actually that good because their deck is better set up for it. So that's where having a clone that can kind of only target your own creatures is actually pretty good. Although, one interesting fact is that cloning Scourge of the Skyclaves actually is always as good as the original Scourge, which is a kind of a cute fact from the modern we live in.
Yeah, now that you mention it, when Humans was very, very popular in Modern, you rarely saw Phantasmal Image copy the opponent's creature. It happened maybe, I don't know, 5% of the time?
I got a Thing in the Ice copied once after it flipped. An Awoken Horror copied. I was like, I had to work so hard for this.
It happened, but it was like pretty rare, and sometimes it was like not even clear that that was the correct decision, because maybe they should have just held it and get a Reflector Mage or a Thalia's Lieutenant or something. But yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. Like, usually the decks are so synergy focused that you're planning to copy your own stuff anyway.
Yeah. You can't really play a clone into an open meta without having a bunch of good targets in your own deck. And so in that sense, it is a drawback, but it's not a huge one.
Yeah, so I think that's encouraging then, that it's not that far off of rate for an effect that can be quite powerful, if Phantasmal Image is any indication. And I've noticed that a lot of decks that used to play Image, Spirits is the main one that I'm thinking of here in Modern, have started playing Glasspool Mimic instead. And I was wondering if that's a case of like strictly, what am I trying to say? Not strictly better or worse, but apart from the Glasspool Mimic costing more and giving you the option of being a land, do you think that the fragility of the image matters at all? Or is it just like you're picking the mimic because you want the option for it to be a land?
Well, anytime you see the card Lava Dart in your opponent's 75, Phantasmal Image gets pretty bad.
True.
And the thing is, with a casting cost, 2 versus 3 on a clone isn't that big of a deal, because typically you won't necessarily have, you're not going to play Phantasmal Image on curve much of the time. It's nice for double spelling purposes or Aether Vial purposes to have it on 2 CMC, but the flexibility of being able to play it as a land means that you can really kind of clean up your mana base and find an extra spot in your deck list that you didn't have otherwise.
Yeah, and I've been just amazed to see like how widespread of an adoption the Glasspool Mimic has had in Modern. It's all over the place. I saw something like 50 published lists already in the time since Zendikar Rising has been released. 50 decks in Modern have been published with Glasspool Mimic in them, and I'll talk about what they are in a second. But I guess the second conceptual question I have is, all right, what am I looking to do with this? Now, a lot of those decks are just like, okay, we're already playing creatures, so like you're saying, Damon, we have a high upside of maybe we can clone one of our lures or something like that. And if we don't want to, we'll just play it as land. But are there any particular synergies that stand out with a mimic that are worth exploring further? Now, I've already talked about the Felidar Guardian one, but what about like Flicker Wisp? Now here I'm thinking of a deck that you played, well, maybe a month ago, Damon, where you're playing that Minotaur instead in like an otherwise mono white deck. You had the red Minotaur just so you could Flicker Wisp it.
Well, the thing is that that Minotaur happens to be Trinium Nemesis, as we discussed. So that provided an interesting B plan to get off to a pretty big start, where an early 4-5 trample actually kind of is bigger, towers over a battlefield sometimes. Whereas I'm not sure that deck had really had a lot of good fodder for Glasspool Mimic. I mean, probably the best card to copy would be Skyclave Apparition, which is certainly a good card. So it's an interesting concept. I mean, playing kind of a mono white Death and Taxes list, but with some Glasspool Mimic, so your Flicker Wisp can every so often, I mean, it can copy your Flicker Wisp first off, which sometimes is interesting because what happens is that your first Flicker Wisp exiles it. It comes back during your end step. So now you have a new Flicker Wisp. So for example, if you target their land, it will be gone until their end step. And so you can use this as like a Rishan Port type effect, which is fine, but a 3-1 flyer plus a port, would you rather just have a 4-5 trampler? You know, one card is Trinium Nemesis and one card is a Flicker Wisp in that situation.
Yeah, I think it might be worth sort of re-exploring that archetype as we're testing this week, just because seeing how many decks have adopted Glasspool Mimic made me wonder, like, maybe we were wrong about which is the just objectively strongest flip creature. Like, maybe it's neither of these. Maybe it's the green mammoth with landfall. Maybe that's the best one. Kind of like, what is the strongest morph to ephemerate? Like, is it the red Achroma, or is it, I don't know what the next strongest morph is.
Yeah, that's why I like your most recent iteration of the Felidar Guardian combo deck, just because Death Shadow is a pretty good Glasspool Mimic target that tends to be the biggest creature on a battlefield. And Ranger Captain is also a good Mimic target because you get both a 3-3 and you'll get another Death Shadow. And so all the targets in that deck are pretty good, besides perhaps copying a Thieves Guild Enforcer is fine. Not super exciting.
All right, so I guess the last question I have is, if I'm going to build a deck and I want to just sort of see what Glasspool can do, I'm going to play a full 4 copies, how should I calculate my mana base? This is obviously the big question that we asked right away when these flip spells were revealed in Zendikar Rising. Like, are we treating it as a land, as a creature, or as both? Is the strength of these cards that they prevent you from being mana screwed early? So if you treat them just as actual spells, you'll have a nice ability to hit all your land drops while still having stuff to cast later? Or are they trying to encourage you to sort of cheat on lands, like just hit the bare minimum number of land drops? If you treat a Glasspool Mimic as one of your just like straight up lands in your mana base, then like, let's say you never want to make land drops past 4 or something, so you actually prevent yourself from flooding out this way. Do you have any inclination on this, Damon, and like the risks involved with treating it as either a land or a spell when calculating your land count?
I have to say, for how long Zendikar Rising has been out, I feel a little embarrassed that I haven't picked up on some kind of like overarching heuristic that it's been like solved one way or the other. I have settled into a personal heuristic, so I'm curious what you think of it. And that's that I typically would consider the first MDFC in the list to count as in a land slot, where you're like, all right, well, I can handle one tap land in here and still have it count as a land, and then have it hedge against flooding in the late game. But then as I add the second one, I start to think of it more like in a spell slot, where now it's hedging against mana screw. And if you're in that sort of situation, you'd much rather have a tap land than no land at all. And so I use like the first one or two to penetrate into the land spots, but then the later ones start to feel more like spells.
Yeah, I've been sort of doing something pretty similar. I hadn't thought of it in those terms explicitly, but I think that's a nice way to just formalize the way that I've been hedging in both directions. One thing that I've noticed is that the decks that have been incorporating it successfully are often somehow cheating in multiple ways, usually with Aethervial. Aethervial is a weird mana source. Like, once it gets going, it taps for potentially 3 mana a turn, but there are also turns where it taps for 0. It having the ability to tap for 3 means that you can sort of like have more 3 drops than you might otherwise realistically want to play for a good curve. And Glasspool Mimic being a 3 drop is like not a problem. It actually makes your Aethervials even better. So let's take a look at some of these lists that have been succeeding. So I'll start with Modern. There have been, as I said, 50 published lists so far, and they kind of fall into 4 broad categories. The first one is Blink strategies. Now, these can be either Soul Herder versions or just a Urion Blink variant. Second, there are just the creature decks that were already playing lots of Lords and that might have already been interested in a card like Phantasmal Image. So we're talking about mainly Spirits and Merfolk, blue decks that are sort of tribal aggro. Third would be sort of a miscellaneous collected company piles. And these decks are more, we'll call them brews, because I'm usually seeing these appear only once or twice. And the fourth category would just be miscellaneous, I'll call it, where they're only playing one or two glass pools as just a land that has some upside. We talked last week about Fluffy Wolf 2's Vesper Lark Reanimator deck, and he was playing two glass pools just because every once in a while, you know, you'll have a Woodfall Primus in play and you'll want to copy it. So why not have a land that lets you do that? You know, huge reward in exchange for having a tap land some of the time. I think the most relevant of all these decks is the blue-white Link, because this deck actually took top 8 in the Showcase Challenge over the weekend. It's actually put up a bunch of results so far, and is starting to look like it might be a contender. So Damon, do you want to sort of talk us through this build?
Yes, so this is kind of a merging of a mono-white Death and Taxes list in Modern with the Giver of Runes, Lunan Arbiter, Stoneforge Mystic, Thalia, Flickerwisp, Skyclave Apparition, some equipment, a bunch of Aether Vials. And then it couples that with kind of a Urion blue-white base. And so what comes along for the ride are some Teferis and Spell Quellers, Glasspool Mimics, and Confounding Conundrum, which is a card that didn't seem to really find a home in Modern or really anywhere until, I guess, this deck, as far as I know. This is the Zendikar Rising enchantment for one in a blue that cantrips and hoses multiple land drops, making your opponent return a land in hand for every additional land beyond the first in a turn. So that surprises me. I'm not sure what changed where that card's good here. Dan, do you have any insight to this?
No, I don't know why it would be like better positioned against the field. We talked about this in our preview show when Urchin Kali was joining us about like how would you use this card, because it does look cool, and I thought that like maybe it just like is a trap. There are so many ways to play around it. You know, you play your fetch land on your turn, wait till their turn to crack it, and it's like the conundrum barely even happened. So you really have to like do some of the work on your end to follow up the conundrum with additional cards to pay you off for it. So here we've got the Field of Ruins to do that. We've got the Path to Exiles that also play in that space. And I guess, I don't know, could you say that Flickerwisp and Lunan Arbiter also contribute to that or not really?
Yeah, one of the strengths of Death and Taxes is the deck just tries to keep your opponent off balance. And so maybe in these off-balance situations is where Confounding Conundrum really shines. And if you ever have them in multiples, they Flickerwisp their land and all of a sudden they're down to like one land. Maybe this deck just kind of creates these situations where, you know, Confounding Conundrum could be played around pretty easily normally, but they're under enough pressure and random prison effects like the Arbiters or the Thalias or the other cards in the deck that they all of a sudden get a little bit, you know, hemmed in by this card. And meanwhile, you're playing Urion, and so you want to have a bunch of cards that have ETBs, and this card always cantrips.
Yeah, so David, what do you think about this take on Confounding Conundrum? This is a card that we talked about as potentially having some kind of home like this, but I think we were a little bit skeptical.
Well, I wasn't skeptical. I really like this card. I don't like these kind of lists with Urion because I feel like my experience, maybe this is not everyone's experience, is that the draws where you have Aether Vial and the draws where you don't have Aether Vial are so different for these taxes lists. And so decreasing the chance that you draw, or whatever you think your best cards are, Lunan Arbiter, or Thalia, or whatever, Stoneforge Mystic, I feel like we kind of know what the best cards in the list are, and it's not like a normal Blink deck where you're just adding a bunch of two mana cards to draw a card. You actually have a really wide variance between how good some of these cards are. So although Urion itself is kind of cute with Aether Vial at times, I don't like the sort of Aether Vial, all these small creatures that are allegedly interchangeable, but they're actually very different, especially depending on the matchup, plus Urion.
Yeah, that's a great point. It reminds me of a 5-0 list that showed up last week that was like a Urion Merfolk deck of some kind. And to get around the Aether Vial problem, they were playing Serum Powder.
I thought of that. The guy that Amhayashi is the guy who started doing that. So the guy who sort of inspired us to try some of those modern lists you guys ran through with the 1-3 wizard, he's been back to Merfolk playing that specifically for that reason. But that addresses exactly what I'm talking about. He's basically making sure his density of Aether Vial opening hands is the same. And then he's gaining things from the Urion. This is saying I can just accept having Aether Vial like 33% loss often. And I don't think that's worth the Urion benefit. And I don't think the cards you're adding in are equivalent. Confounding Conundrum, you know, can be good in some matchups. Obviously, Teferi is a great card. But some of the, I mean, not all these cards add up to exactly how powerful, you know, specifically Arbor can be or Stoneforge Massacre, et cetera. So, but they're having success with it. So obviously there's nothing wrong with it. I do feel like the place of like, if you're going to play Teferi, people should be just considering Spellqueller more often. I think the card's really good. And Teferi is just a great card, especially against the other Omnath piles.
Yeah. Yeah. Classic combo. But on that subject, so Glasspool Mimic here has a bunch of creatures that it can potentially copy, but a lot of them don't really work with it. Like, you don't necessarily want to copy a Spellqueller at sorcery speed. There's no way to, like, insta-blink it with a Felidar Guardian, right? Flickerwisp is a slow blink. You don't want to copy Thalia. Copying Arbiter is not super great, but maybe it actually doesn't matter. Like, do we just expect that, like Damon said, you're just trying to disrupt them a little bit and then use the time you've created to get some chip damage in with the creatures, and it doesn't matter what Glasspool is copying?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it has about 12 good targets in the form of the Skyclave Apparitions, the Stoneforge Mystics, and the Flickerwisps. And then if you have the Aether Vial, yeah, you have these tricky lines with Glasspool Mimic copying Spellqueller. That's a fun one. Beyond that, yeah, it's a little underwhelming what it can copy. Although, obviously, copying a Urien is at least interesting.
Well, this is a list that I think I'm excited to just try and see how it plays.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the issue to always remember is that Glasspool Mimic doesn't ever have to copy anything. Just putting a land into play is fine. So you'd never play a 3-mana clone, but again, it's the options in Magic historically just make cards a lot better than they seem. You know, when Drawn the Lot came, we were like, is this even worth a 1-of slot in Niv-Mizzet? You know, we were debating, and then it's just become like a borderline staple in decks that can cast it because the optionality is just so powerful. And so when there's nothing to copy, it's a land. And when there is something to copy, it's a clone. And that's something that clone can never say. It doesn't matter that you can clone their other cards, because when that doesn't matter, the clone is literally the ace of spades.
Yeah. This deck is actually, I'm excited to try it also, Dan. It's just so strange, though. I mean, Thalia's plus Confounding Conundrums and Teferi's, like, these cards don't work well together. Along with the, you know, we've accepted that, you know, Leonin Arbiter and Stoneforge Mystic do work together, even if they're not best friends.
Yeah.
I will also say, I think Glasspool Mimic copying Giver of Runes, like the second Giver of Runes is when it starts to get to misery for your opponent that's relying on spot removal. So,
yeah. Even though you're kind of down on mana, 3 CMC to copy a 1 CMC, it is a nice little pseudo lock.
It can do its best mom impression.
It's not your real mom, but okay.
No.
That's okay.
Your real mom went out for cigarettes and never came back.
It's your rogue mom.
All right, so we move on to discuss briefly just these tribal aggro decks. I said that Spirits decks in Modern and Merfolk decks seem to be picking up the Glasspool Mimics, but humans are not. Does that sound about right to you guys, or what's the difference? Why would you want it in Spirits and Merfolk but not in humans?
My guess is that the blue mana basically does not cast anything in humans, and so the half of the card that we're saying is kind of saves it from being a slightly overcosted clone is basically zero, and the 8-tap blue mana is actually a card you would play in Merfolk and a card you would play in Spirits.
Yeah, I think the difference might be that humans used to play Phantasmal Image, and that's a card that was pretty good in that deck, but they then got cards like General Kudrow, and so humans have kind of gotten additional heavy hitters that maybe take the spots that you would put these clones in. You could just play more General Kudrows.
I was wondering if it was along the lines of what David was saying, that like the humans deck, I think of it as a curve out aggro deck. Like, yes, it plays Vile like the Spirits and Merfolk deck, but it's also playing Noble Hierarch and generally trying to tap out every turn. You know, if you're not casting creatures, you're at least cracking canopy lands. Whereas Spirits and Merfolk, I feel like they are more content to play on the opponent's turn, and if they waste mana, so be it.
Also, it's worth noting the way that the lords work in both of those tribes, the second lord is worth a lot. So the second Lord of Atlantis means that all of the Merfolk you have in play have Island Walk, right? It grants Island Walk to the other lord, and it grants Island Walk to your clone. And the Spirit Lord grants Hexproof to all other spirits, so that second spirit is the lock against removal. So I think in that case, you're getting paid off from that second lord. Drogskull Captain is the one I'm thinking of. So maybe that's part of it as well. You know, an extra, they're only really playing like a couple lords in humans. One of them is General Kudrow. That's not a good card to copy. So the other lord is the one that puts +1/+1 counters on. When you have less lords to copy, also the clone effect is a little weaker.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the third category that I mentioned was just sort of miscellaneous company decks, where I think players are identifying correctly that you can sort of build extra company hits into your mana base by playing some number of Glasspool Mimics and maybe cheating your overall ratio of lands and creatures, right? So the collected company will see the Glasspool Mimic as a creature if you have it in the top six. So there's a few different lists here. I mean, none of them jump out as stock lists by any stretch, but you know, they play some combination of Stoneforge Mystics and Spell Quellers and Skyclad Apparitions, but also Collected Companies, trying to take advantage of the fact that the Glasspool Mimic is CMC3. Some of them combine that with Company and Ethervile, so the player Antoine 57437. He's been on this deck for so long that I even know his numbers, 57437, without having to check them. By the way, I think he got top 16 in the weekend challenge on like a 17 land Wily Company deck. Yeah, I mean, is the Glasspool Mimic a major level up here, or is it just like another card you can consider in your pile of creatures?
I mean, looking at the numbers for these lists, you know, it seems to just be, you know, a marginal gain around the edges. It's only often a one or two of. I think it's exactly like what you're saying. You're decreasing your chance of getting hosed and marginally increasing the value of the average company hit. And then in the late game, it just is pure value. It's a lot better than a creature land would be because it's just permanently a creature.
Yeah, these are decks where the key MVP of recent sets is definitely Skyclave Apparition. And Glasspool Mimic is kind of showing up being like, hey, I'm a cool Zendikar Rising card too. Look at me. As I get flipped into a land most of the time.
That's not to take anything away from the Mimic, the fact that Apparition is a better card. I think that it's just cool that it has, that this style of deck has more support now. I think that just the existence of both Vial and Company really rewarding you for putting a bunch of three drops in your deck makes these three CMC flip creatures like a little bit more attractive than they might otherwise be. Because you don't really want to build a deck that's so heavy on three drops, and yet Company and Ethervile really reward you for doing so. So just like having the option to have lands that are also three CMC creatures is nice. And for that reason, I consider the Glasspool Mimic, I consider even the Mammoth, or even the Black Bloom Rogue.
Yeah, what's interesting about Antoine 57437, list is with Ephemerate, is that you can kind of change which creature Glasspool Mimic is copying.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a couple also results with Soul Herder, one from Jonas B., one from Cheggs de Pug, both playing multiple copies of Glasspool Mimic in the Soul Herder Ephemerate strategy. And then just to round things out, there's been some weird ones. We talked about the Vesperlark Reanimator deck. There's even a Heartless Summoning Gitrog Monster Primeval Titan deck where only played one Glasspool Mimic, but maybe they should have played more. I mean, that is a card that is reduced dramatically in cost by Heartless Summoning, and you get to like have more payoffs essentially in your deck. That's also the trick with Heartless Summoning is you need enough creatures to pay you off for the summoning, but you also like can't have too many of them because then your deck doesn't function without the summoning.
Yeah, what's interesting about this list is that it's one of the only lists that plays creatures that Glasspool Mimic kind of goes up on mana, where you copy a prime time and you're kind of plus three on mana, which sounds both cool, like, oh wow, that must be powerful, like, you know, you get another prime time. On the other hand, as anybody who's played Modern knows, the first prime time is usually good enough to win the game.
But that second prime time, though... Talking about two prime times.
Yeah, this is a deck that really needs a Dryad to function. So it's playing Dread Presence to take advantage of swamp hits to do a Valakut Impression. Also, it's playing two Valakuts, even though it has no use for red mana at all. So it's a pretty cool brew, kind of mixing sort of existing what we know about Amulet of Vigor lists with black for the Gitrog monster Dread Presence. I don't know if you don't want to call it a combo or not, but the synergies there.
What if I just like wanted to increase the mimics by like a large number, play full four?
I mean, you can always cut lands for them.
Like this build doesn't really do anything in the first turns. It even has Amulet of Vigor, so you're not super punished by playing a tap land.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, so we're just brainstorming, getting some decks on the table here. David, you've been kicking around one possible use of the Glasspool Mimic in Modern. Do you want to tell us about your build?
Yeah, so like... 4 weeks ago. You know, we're always chatting about possible ideas for the pod on GChat in the middle of the day. So I think it was maybe like on a lunch break. We, you know, I was ranting and raving about how much I really was enjoying this mimic. And I think you pointed out, or maybe someone in our Discord, the sort of Felidar Guardian Glasspool mimic interaction. So then the question came from, I don't know, one of you guys, like, what can we do? All right, we have infinite creatures coming into play. What's the least worst way we can sort of exploit that while we're still playing usable creatures? And so at the time, I think red-black was a little more dominant. I was like, wow, like Auriok Champion is a card you might already want to main deck. This interaction with Auriok Champion just gives you infinite life. And infinite life doesn't win that many matches, but it does beat all the prowess decks. I don't think any of them can beat infinite life. If you're playing infinite life anyway, you could put Heliod the Sun Crown in your list and infinite life becomes infinite damage. And if we're playing Heliod, then we should probably play Ranger Captain Eos. That lets us play some number of Walking Ballista in our deck. So we kind of have that combo built in. And then I wanted to just at least try out Anafenza Kintree Spirit. So that actually generates infinite power with this combo. You just have to stack your trigger. So you put your Anafenza Kintree Spirit trigger on the stack first, then your blink. The blink will resolve. It'll trigger Anafenza Kintree and the blink again. You put the Anafenza Kintree. So you basically blink your creatures over and over again, and then at the end of it, you have all of these +1/+1 counters waiting to be added. Unfortunately, you're going to have to do a lot to get your infinite power because it always goes on the creature that has the lowest toughness or tied for the lowest toughness. So I think that infinite combo is actually pretty powerful, but I think it's going to be quite miserable to play on Magic Online. So hopefully your opponent throws down to it, but I cannot guarantee that he or she will.
So the way you're doing it is you're trying to stack all the bolts or triggers like at the bottom of the stack and resolve everything else?
Exactly. So every time a Felidar Guardian comes into play, if there's another Felidar Guardian, you'll get a bolster trigger and a Felidar Guardian trigger. So you put that bolster trigger on the stack, you put the Felidar Guardian blink trigger targeting the other Felidar Guardian on the stack last. That trigger resolves, another Felidar Guardian comes into play, and the same thing happens, a bolster trigger and a Felidar blink trigger. And then you once again put the bolster trigger on. So you're just stacking up all these bolster triggers. Now what happens at the end, though, let's say you just have one Kintree Spirit and two Felidar Guardians. After the first three counters are put on the Anafenza Kintree Spirit, you have to put another +1/+1 counter on each of your no longer blinking Felidar Guardians before you can put the fourth counter on, and et cetera, et cetera. So you have to add like 50 counters to do 20 damage, for instance. So I am actually a little worried about that. I think that's going to be like a legitimate impediment to playing with this deck. I would throw down to it if it was me, but
we just throw some Jace Wielder of Clocks into the deck.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the other concern I have is that the infinite life combo, what I've learned from the Thieves Guild Enforcer loop is that it takes 7 clicks to mill 2 cards. And it's fidgety. I mean, you have to select yes or no every time the Felidar Guardian resolves. You can yield to its trigger, but then you also have to choose what to blink. You have to choose what creature the Glasspool Mimic is copying, and then you have to put that on the stack when there's 2 triggers going on the stack. It's just like a ton of clicks to do one loop. And at least when you're milling them, you know, they see that you have to click 7 times, but their library is depleting. If it's just gaining life, I mean, they'll just probably just let you click it out. If there's any stakes at all in the match, they would just let you click as many times as you want. You know, you lose 6 minutes every time you try to do it.
Yeah, so it's hard to say. Like, I think playing with this deck will be miserable for that reason. I'm actually like going into it with my eyes wide open. At the same time, I think you can learn a lot about, is the combo actually good? You'll know if you would have won that game, and we can report back on it. I do think that being able to main deck 4 Auriok Champions and a bunch of ways to use them to go infinite means you have a literal buy against all the prowess lists and Jund if you play that. So you have multiple ways to go infinite life in a creature that blocks and just gives you a ton of time. So I think you need to bend your entire sideboard to beating these other decks that are trying to go over the top of you on combo lists. So I don't know the best way to do that, but that's something I would really have to like focus my sideboard on.
Yeah, and you're not that far off of the Luminarch Aspirant version of this deck, where you're trying to just get the Ballista Heliod kill as soon as you can. And you've got 3 Heliods, 2 Ballistas, 3 Ranger Captains here. So potentially, maybe if you just like were willing to sacrifice a Stoneforge package, you could put more of the Ballista combo in.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is the big question is, do you want to dedicate the 6 or 7 slots of the Stoneforge package requires? My instinct was yes, just because, as you've talked about, Dan, I always want to have a reasonable Felidar Guardian target. You know, if the infinite blinks doesn't do anything unless you have one of those other 6 cards in play. So when you're not doing that, I would like to blink a Stoneforge Mystic, and the Felidar Guardian has a very good interaction with Batterskull. You know, a lot of times it can kill the first germ, but you reset it effortlessly with your Felidar Guardian. And so that's quite powerful as well. So yeah, I guess it remains to be seen whether it's worth it or not, but I do think that's the big question. Like you say, then you can sort of fill out your slots with the 4th Ranger Captain, the 4th Heliod, and, you know, a couple extra Walking Blitzes and Giver, and just kind of be all in on, not all in, but you can basically just be like a 2 combo deck then.
I have to say, I'm always a little skeptical of David's double combo lists. But we'll have to try it.
So to your question, David, of like, what is the least bad way to profit off a Felidar Guardian loop? Warrior Champion is a good card. Thieves' Guild Enforcer is something that the jury is still out. The answer that is like clearly a bad card is Altar of the Brood. That's a 1-mana artifact that mills the opponent for 1 whenever a permanent of any kind enters under your control. So Felidar Guardians each, whenever they come in, they mill 1. That's the kind of card that you could find with Karin the Great Creator if you wanted to, or even like Trinket Mage, thinking about your didgeridoo.
Trinket Mage. I literally was thinking about it today because I was looking at this didgeridoo list, and Trinket Mage is a reasonable card to copy with Glasspool Mimic because it does draw a card.
What would the artifacts be that you get, though?
Well, I'm wondering if you'd make a Chalice deck then. So you could set your Chalice on 1 early, and then you can just blink it out of existence when you want to play or when you wanted to go for your combo.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess you could always grab Mishra's Baubles too. I don't know that like a Chalice on turn 4 is that valuable.
Yeah, that might be true. Engineered Explosives obviously is a fine card.
Okay. All right, I'm willing to play with this. I'm willing to play around with this a little bit. Okay, so that is one take on a modern build. Just to briefly round things out with a glance at Pioneer, what I found when I was researching Glasspool Mimic in Pioneer is that it really has not caught on at all there. What do I mean by that? Well, there's 3 types of decks that play it. I found about 25-ish lists published so far with Glasspool Mimic. One is that the Spirits deck plays about 1 copy of Mimic. The modern build plays more, but the Spirits only plays 1. There is an archetype called, I'm going to call it Bant Blink, that is just like a collected company deck with, you know, it's got Urien and it's got some Charming Princes, but the cards you're blinking with, like, there's no Felidar Guardian here, there's no Flicker Wisp here, so you're not actually going to blink the Glasspool Shore and have it come back as a Glasspool Mimic. That's not possible. You're just going to find the Glasspool Mimic maybe off company, or maybe you hardcast it, and then you have the option to change it up with a Charming Prince or a Teferi or something like that. So I'm wondering, like, why this is the case? Like, why has this card not picked up in Pioneer?
I mean, I just think creature decks are bad in Pioneer, and so without good creatures to copy, you know, I considered it, for instance, in my, like, Sultai Thwart the Grey, but all the creatures that are really good there are basically legends.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've been playing it as a 1 or 2 of in a bunch of lists, as listeners will have noticed, when it was copying the Exert Dragon, when it's copying the Rogue Lord. I mean, it just has a lot of utility. It can slip very easily in any deck that's tapping, that needs islands, as like a 1 or 2 of.
Yeah, one hypothesis is that there's no Aether Vial in Pioneer.
Mm.
Yeah, I can see that. Right, because the list that you've been testing, David, it wasn't the Glasspool Mimic's faults, per se. It's just that the decks, they have a tall order trying to compete with the heavily polarized metagame in Pioneer, end up being mid-range decks with creatures that are vulnerable to kill spells and they're not super fast, so...
Yeah, and I mean, I would say I've been very happy with the card and that the lists I've been putting it in have actually been pretty good. I think I've 4-1 with a bunch of lists that have had like 1 or 2 in them. So I think there's definitely space for the card. I actually think it's much more a Pioneer level card in terms of the untapped, or playing a tap blue is not something you can get away with as much in Modern, and it does feel like something you're more likely to be able to get away with in Pioneer.
I'm going to try to tinker with this some more this week, just Pioneer builds with Glasspool Mimic, and I'll start with maybe some of your old lists, David. I was also wondering if we can try to just somehow port the Vial Company basic shell from Modern into Pioneer. And I think, Damon, you're right that just without other Vial, you just can't do it. But if you want to, like, play Collected Company, you do have the option to play either the Mimic or the Black Bloom Rogue or the Khazad-dûm Mammoth to get kind of like virtual three drops out of your mana base. And that frees you up to play some of the interactive pieces that you need in Pioneer. Like you kind of need Thoughtseize pushed around the lock if you're going to be a rogue deck, for example. And that means that you don't have enough creatures for Collected Company. Unless you're willing to play like four Glassful Mimics and maybe four Black Bloom Rogues as part of your mana base. So I'm wondering if like that is like a plausible way to build a deck. What do you guys think?
It's definitely a very clever way to push the limits of Collected Company. And, you know, these Black Bloom Rogue cards, they're not obviously, Pioneer capable on their first cut. But with Collected Company and the fact that they sit as a land, hard to say without trying it.
Yeah, and I mean, you obviously will end up having to play a lot of tap lands, and that presents its own challenges, so I'm not sure that this can be solved, but it's something I'm going to tinker with, and I'll report back on my findings next week.
Yeah, I wonder if we start going this route, if we should maybe consider Dan's favorite mechanic of party, and so maybe our only rogues would be like Glintsleeve Siphoner and maybe some Rogue Refiners. I mean, basically, I'm a little scarred by the, like, finding my opponent's Uros over and over again. And the way this mana base is built, you're not going to be able to have an easy way to Fatal Push anything that costs more than two. You won't be able to play Fabled Passage. So I think that Fatal Push will actually be quite bad in this list. And that is a cause of alarm for me. So
I see what you're saying. All right, well, let's explore it. If it turns out that the rogues are a problem, we can push this back to party week and maybe come back to it then. But I think we're out of time now, so we'll leave it here. Damon, do you want to take us out?
Yeah, so until next week, we hope that you have both a good day and then another mimicked good day of league results. So you get a 2.5 wins and copy that again for the clean 5-0. Otherwise, as always, stay safe and stay healthy and stay sane.
See you.
Take care.
That brings us to the end of episode 80 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Thanks again for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we look forward to hearing from you. You can find us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. And if you'd like to leave us a review in your podcast player, that would also be a tremendous help. Those reviews always bring a smile to our face, and they help new listeners discover the cast. You can also support the show directly by joining our Patreon. There are lots of rewards and benefits that you'll receive by becoming a supporter, not least of which is a shout-out from David Robertson in the week that you join. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is where you can find all of the details. We hope to see you there. That's all for this week. Stay safe and happy brewing.